Thanks, Matt, and good afternoon, everybody. I'm Tom Hall. Glad you're with us here for Midday. Today, Midday goes to the museum. Two museums, in fact. A little later, Marvin Pinkert, the director of the Jewish Museum of Maryland, will join me to talk about their current exhibition, Beyond Chicken Soup, Jews and Medicine in America. But first, I'm happy to welcome Christopher Bedford to the show. He's the newly appointed director of the Baltimore Museum of Art. Came to Baltimore in August after 4 years as the head of the Rose Art Museum at Brandeis University in Boston. So welcome to town. It's good to see you.
Very pleased to be here.
Yeah, you know, I think there's like a three-month statute of limitations where you're still the new kid.
Really?
You know.
I had heard that you can be in Baltimore for a very, very long time, and unless you went to high school here, you'll never be a native, but
well,
I'm trying.
Well, that's true. I mean, I've been here 35 years and I'm still a foreigner, but you know, but it's like after Thanksgiving, people are going to say, oh, Bedford, is he still around? We are also joined by Katie Rothkopf. She's the senior curator of European painting and sculpture at the BMA and one of the two scholars who have put together a wonderful new exhibition that juxtaposes the work of the great French master Henri Matisse and the acclaimed American painter Richard Diebenkorn. It's called, simply enough, Matisse-Diebenkorn, and it opens on Sunday. Katie, it's always good to see you.
Wonderful to be here.
You're an old hand at this. You know, we go back a long ways. We would love to have you all join our conversation today about the BMA and about the Jewish Museum a little bit later. You can give us a call at 410-662-8780. You can send us an email, midday@wipr.org or @midday Tom Hall, if you want to send us a tweet. So, Chris, you've been here, you know, a couple months. I mean, you started on the 15th of August. What have you learned about Charm City? What do you think so far?
So I love it so far. It's been a swift integration. The board of the museum has been incredibly helpful in helping me acclimate to Baltimore. I think the museum is just as staggering as I imagined it would be. We have vast, vast potential. And we're doing great things already. So I feel very encouraged about the next 5 to 7, 10 years. And I think that the Matisse-Diebenkorn show that Katie put together is a gift-wrapped perfect beginning for me.
Yeah, it really is quite a way to come out of the gate.
That, yes,
that's
indeed.
True. I mean, when you're up at Brandeis and before that you're in Columbus, Ohio,
yes,
University of Ohio.
Yes.
What attracted you to Baltimore? Why was the BMA a good gig for you?
I would say it was a combination of factors. One is the depth and richness of the collection. That, of course, is first and foremost. I would say that it's a city that seems to care about art, that seems deeply invested in culture and its relationship to progress, civic, social progress within the city. And my strong sense is that the board of the museum was very supportive of a reinvention of the museum's relationship to a global audience on one hand and a local audience on the other. So it ignited my sense of ambition. I think it's not incidental, too, that the holdings at the museum are particularly strong from, say, 1900 to the present. And while my expertise is 1945 to the present, that span and those riches struck me as very enticing.
Mm-hmm. And Katie, speaking of those holdings, Matisse certainly holds a treasured place in the panoply of the holdings at the BMA. Talk a little bit about the history of Matisse, the Matisse collection at the BMA, in particular, the contributions of the Cohn sisters.
Yes, well, Clarabelle and Etta Cohn were amazing patrons to the city of Baltimore. They put together an incredible collection of works by Matisse and other modern masters. And when Etta Cohn died in 1949, 20 years after her sister Clarabelle, she left her entire collection to the BMA, including more than 500 works by Matisse. Some of the most incredible paintings that he ever made, a wonderful selection of his sculpture, terrific prints and spectacular drawings, and many of his illustrated books. Over the course of the years since then, the museum has been very lucky to have even added to that. So we are now well over 1,000 works by Matisse, have over 1,000 works by Matisse in our collection, making us the largest repository of his work in the world.
In the world, yeah.
Yes.
And did you draw on some of that repository for this particular exhibition?
Oh, of course. The show, we always try to do projects that focus on the collection and provide a new context or a new way to look at what we have at the museum. And so when I started to think about this show 15 years ago, I wanted to take Matisse and really put him in a more, in a contemporary context, and look at artists of subsequent generations who were influenced by him. And so we have 8 paintings by Matisse from the Cohn collection in the show, as well as some drawings, and that really provides a great basis to start.
But there's something like 90 objects and paintings in this show?
92 works, painting and drawings by both artists, 56 by Diebenkorn and 36 by Matisse.
That's a huge... I mean, I saw the show last night. You all had a very swell party with, 150 of our closest personal friends. And we got a chance to walk through the collection, which is... or the exhibition, which is really quite extraordinary. Chris, one of the things that strikes me is, in your business, because you're a former... You're a reformed curator, and Katie is a curator now. This juxtaposition...
Right.
Of one artist next to another.
Mm-hmm.
So you walk through this exhibition, and I guess it's kind of done, Katie, chronologically, right? I mean, we see early works of Diebenkorn and how they were influenced by Matisse. Is that right?
Right. Yeah, the show follows Diebenkorn's chronology, beginning the first work in the show by him is from 1953, and it sort of traverses his career until 1980, towards the end of his career. He died in 1993. With the Matisses that he saw or would have found interesting, interspersed when they make sense. It's not a show that pairs them one for one. As I said before, there are more Diebenkorns than Matisses. But we've tried very hard to find the Matisse works that he found particularly inspiring, which took a lot of legwork and a lot of research. But it really has worked together beautifully.
Yeah. And so, Chris, when you do this, because you guys are in the business of this juxtaposition, mm-hmm. you guys mm-hmm. are in the business of establishing these narratives, if you will, between artists and the story of people's development as an artist and how one is influenced. So in this case, it's Diebenkorn being influenced by Matisse. Is there ever a danger, a chance of sort of attenuating the individual contribution of either artist, or 2 or 3 or 4 artists, if you put them mm-hmm. that much? I mean, I always wondered about that, because mm-hmm. In music, which is the thing that I know a little bit more about, a lot more about, actually, mm-hmm. than visual art, people talk about, well, it's derivative of so-and-so. Mm-hmm. Copeland is mm-hmm. this held up as this great example of unique, mm-hmm. A unique American sound, and he's unlike anybody else. But did you name a whole bunch of other mm-hmm. people? Oh, he's influenced by so-and-so, and she's influenced by so-and-so. I mean, I wonder, is that ever a danger, that all of a sudden Diebenkorn will just seem derivative of Matisse?
I mean, I think it could be if the show were handled by somebody less adept than Katie is. So, and I think this is where I would say it's less a dyad than it is a triangulation. So to me, there is Matisse and there's Diebenkorn, and then there's the curator as interlocutor or interrogator or investigator. And I think one very influential critic once said to me when I was a young man beginning to write, the proof is in the pudding. And I think I was waxing lyrical about something. He said to me, well, but is it good? And I would say that the juxtaposition of the two, as orchestrated by Katie, is mutually illuminating. You see Matisse in a different light, and you see Diebenkorn in a different light. And I think that that's a very unique thing that encyclopedic institutions are able to do. We can change the past and change the viewer's conception of the future of painting as well. I don't think it's any surprise that Matisse is seen by younger people, a huge younger generation of influential painters, both abstract and figurative, as the great French modernist. No question. You hear this over and over again. So to see that kind of conviction borne out across the career of somebody as influential as Diebenkorn, I think is enormously convincing. So the proof is in the pudding. I would say see the show and you'll be very convinced.
Yeah, there's a lot of very delicious pudding in this show, Katie. There really is. And I enjoyed feasting on it last night. But that is the point of doing this, right? To learn more about both Matisse and Diebenkorn. I mean, in this instance, we're talking about how Diebenkorn is influenced by Matisse, but it's not... We also learn a little bit about Matisse in the process as well. We learn about both.
Oh, we definitely learn about both. In doing the research for the show, we did a lot of work to see what Matisses were on view in the United States. What were the opportunities for David?
So what he would have seen.
What he would have seen. He was lucky to have been introduced to Matisse's work in 1943 in a private collection, the private collection of Sarah Stein, who was the sister-in-law of Gertrude and Leo Stein, who had lived in Paris for a very long time, moved back to California. And when Diebenkorn was at Stanford and was a young college art student, was invited to have lunch at her house and saw for the first time Matisse's work. And it really just, you know, really blew him away.
And it's kind of serendipitous then. I mean, if Miss Stein had happened to collect Picasso instead of Matisse or collect somebody else we've never heard of, that could have changed the game considerably.
It could have. Now, she did have those things, too. I mean, he saw a range of things at her house, but it was the Matisses that really stuck. And from that point forward, he started to seek them out at every opportunity that he could. The following year at the Phillips Collection, we were stationed on the East Coast while he was serving as a Marine, and he was living at Quantico. And he would spend his weekends going to the Phillips Collection in Washington, to the Museum of Modern Art, to the National Gallery, to the Philadelphia Museum of Art. And each time
On, he even visited the Baltimore Museum of Art, right?
He did. That was a little tidbit that we learned during our research, that, in fact, he had come to Baltimore. So it's such an interesting story. So, you know, we learned a little bit more about Matisse's exhibition history here in the United States, which is very important. But I think seeing them together, there's some interesting passages of Matisse's work where you may have thought of them as being, you know, simply decorative, simply pretty, simply easy on the eye. But when you look at them next to a Diebenkorn, you see that he's the process and his interest in every little bit of the composition is something that you see reflected much more strongly in this particular context.
Yeah. And Chris Bedford, putting together a show like this, I mean, Katie mentioned that she first ginned up this idea 15 years ago, which is, you know, an incredible labor of love and tenacity. But of the many things in the world I know nothing about, putting together an art exhibition is top of the list. So it's an amazingly complex thing because you've gotten paintings and artifacts from all sorts of different collections. That doesn't come easy, does it?
No,
it's not a matter of just picking up the phone and saying, hey, can we have this one and this one for a couple of years?
No, it doesn't work that way, not at all. I mean, I think that what Katie has done with this exhibition, I would say, is, you know, increasingly rare. But something that museums should absolutely remain committed to. So 15 years in gestation.
Why is it increasingly rare? I mean, why aren't museums jumping at the chance to combine, collaborate, and, you know, put together something that can be so important in terms of scholarship, et cetera?
Well, I would say that there is a demand for museums today to confiscate the attention of their publics again and again and again with sort of monotonous regularity. And if something doesn't work, then you change and change again. So that isn't always conducive to giving a curator extended periods of time to develop an idea in a scholarly fashion, to do the research necessary to gather this precise works necessary to articulate the argument. I think what makes this show so specifically interesting is that these aren't just examples of Matisse or examples of Diebenkorn. These are specific things chosen to illustrate a particular point. So to give a person the time necessary to do that work, I would, in my experience, is an increasing rarity. So I'm proud to be able to do it, and it's something that we'll continue to do for sure.
And Katie, so you chose these specific paintings, these specific drawings, these specific little books for specific purposes. This isn't, as Chris says, just, oh, here's a nice one, here's a nice one. I mean, you are like decorating a room with just exactly the furniture you want, right? I mean, you're blanching at that horrible metaphor, but I mean, you had an idea specifically. Okay, here's what Diebenkorn did in this painting. So therefore, the Matisse that inspired it, or, you know, helped it along in some way, you knew exactly the Matisse you needed.
Let me be clear. There were certain Matisses that we knew were particularly important to Diebenkorn, and I think showing those particular examples together was something, you know, Diebenkorn has been linked to Matisse for a very long time, and there were certain works we really felt we had to have the show work at all. And at a certain point, when those really came through, We then looked for other works that we knew he had seen or were that we thought he had seen that were a little that where we thought we saw resonances. So it's not as though with every Matisse in this show, he definitely saw it and it made him do the work next to it. It's that there's a little bit that perhaps he remembered or a little bit that where you see a connection. It's a subtle and nuanced view of both artists and their connection to each other.
Yeah, and the complexity is wonderful. Terrific. We're going to come back in a little bit. Christopher Bedford is the director of the Baltimore Museum of Art. Katie Rothkopf is their senior curator of European painting and sculpture at the BMA and the brains behind the big new exhibition that opens on Sunday called Matisse Diebenkorn. You can join our conversation if you'd like, 410-662-8780. You can send us an email, midday@wipr.org, or you can drop us a tweet at @MiddayTomHall. A little music of Erik Satie. We'll have a little bit of words from our sponsors, as it were, and we will be back in 90 seconds. Stick around.
This is your public radio, member-supported 88.1 WYPR, your NPR news station.
And welcome back. It's Midday at the Museum. Coming up a little bit later today, we'll hear about the new exhibition at the Jewish Museum of Maryland that explores the connection between Jews and medicine in America. By the way, coming up Monday on the broadcast, a new report on the relationship between Catholics and Muslims in the United States. It's called Danger and Dialogue. It examines how Muslims are portrayed in the Catholic press and how Catholics' views on Islam comport and or diverge from the rest of the population. We'll talk to the researcher who compiled the data, as well as a Catholic scholar and a Muslim scholar who studies what's been broken in the past and what can be fixed in the future. That's all coming up on Midday Monday. It's part of our continuing series on religion, Living Questions. I'm Tom Hall. Today we will take your questions and comments for the new director of the Baltimore Museum of Art, Christopher Bedford, and Katie Rothkopf. She's the curator who, along with Janet Bishop in San Francisco, has assembled the latest show at the BMA, Matisse Diebenkorn. You can get in touch with us by giving us a buzz at 410-662-8780 or send us an email, midday@wipr.org, or you can drop us a tweet. Our handle is @MiddayTomHall. Chris Bedford, how do you look at a painting? I mean, what do you do when you first encounter a painting? I mean, I know how I react when I first hear a song. Most of the time, I know right away whether I love it or am neutral or agnostic about it or hate it. Do you have the same reaction when you see a painting?
So it's a more, slightly more specialized encounter with an object. I think it's not as day-to-day as music is. And somebody once said to me, people don't know where to begin and end with painting. They don't know what the first gasp is and what the disengagement looks like. I would say that I actually do look for, as you suggest, that initial moment of seduction. So I do want a long-term engagement, an act of close looking, a protracted exchange with the object. But generally speaking, the seduction that happens with the first encounter is really important to sustain the interest over time. So not dissimilar from your encounter with a song, for instance.
When you say close looking,
yes.
What does that mean? Like you get your eyeball right, you know, 3 inches away from the canvas?
Yes.
You're looking at the brush strokes and
right.
stuff?
So I was taught very traditional art history. And in fact, Casey and I just learned today, went to the same college. Oberlin College, and it was a program very much grounded in looking at objects, learning from objects, and thinking from objects. And I would say that thinking from a physical painting is extremely different from thinking from a reproduction of a painting. So yes, that does necessitate getting very close to the surface, understanding the application of the pigment to the surface, just speaking about painting here, and extrapolating from there to draw your conclusions. So this is one of the great attributes of this show, of course, is that it causes you to look very, very closely at the surface of the painting and understand. I mean, to me, the show is about the nature of influence. That's essentially
the nature of
the
influence.
Yes, and what it means for an artist to be influenced by another. I think it's an incredibly dicey, difficult thing to dissect. And for one person to look to another creative person for influence and then take that and turn it to your own purposes. So to see that happening, I think, is unbelievably interesting. So that as a lens for closed looking is something, yeah, I think it's a privilege.
And Katie, you were talking about the complexities and the sort of subtle ways in which that influence is manifested, which is really interesting. We're going to go to the phones. Vincent DePaul is on the phone from Baltimore. Vincent, welcome to the show.
Yes, hi there. How are you? I'm so happy. I'm a native Baltimorean, and I flew in because I'm doing a show locally here. I'm an Academy member and a two-time Emmy winner, but native of Maryland. And I am so fascinated by Matisse and that how you curated Katie and Christopher, this wonderful collection. Specifically, my question was, with Henri Matisse, the collections that you put together, are you aware of the Hausner's restaurant, which at Hausner's in Southeast Baltimore, they had such a great collection from the 1920s and onward? And how did that occur? And did you in any way, was that previewed by you, or did you see any of that work? And has any of those Maryland collectors, were they ever, besides the wonderful Cohn sisters, integrated in the collection?
Well, that's interesting, Vincent. I ate at Hausner's many times in the 80s. It hasn't been around for quite a while. They actually had Matisse paintings hanging on the walls at Hausner's?
They had so many inspired paintings from so many different eras, and I was just wondering if Katie and Christopher were savvy to those. I know that they did an entire episode on Mad Men where they showed, they recreated Hausner's restaurant, and there were Matisse's in Hausner's restaurant on set in Mad Men.
They couldn't have been original, though. I mean,
of course not. They're set dressed.
Okay, so I just want to make sure that you had that. I mean, were there other collectors here in Baltimore besides the Cohn sisters who had significant collections of Matisse?
I think there were a few with a couple of things, but nothing of anywhere near that range. I think when Hausner's closed, there were a couple of things from the collection that did come to the museum, but not works by Matisse. I think some, as I recall, some sculpture has come into the collection after they closed, but no Matisse paintings that I'm aware of. No Matisse paintings, certainly.
Mm-hmm. You show quite vividly how strong the influence of Matisse on Diebenkorn is in this show. Is it also a fact or known that Matisse was influenced by specific particular painters?
Well, Paul Cézanne was Matisse's, I think he considered him his artistic mentor. They also never met. And he really fell hard for Cézanne's work early on. He actually bought a small painting by Cézanne of bathers that his wife had to pawn an engagement ring to pay for it, which she was willing to do. And he had it in his house and in his studio for over 30 years before eventually giving it to a museum in Paris. So for him, you know, Cézanne was someone that really he looked up to so much. And it's interesting, Diebenkorn loved Cézanne's work too. So
yeah, I wonder, is there a lineage that you can sort of trace Cézanne to Matisse to Diebenkorn?
There's definitely a lineage. And there's a beautiful wall of still lives in the exhibition where you can see Matisse looking at Cézanne, Matisse really coming into his own, and then Diebenkorn looking at both of them. So that's been a great part of the show to work on.
It's Midday at the Museums. You can join us by giving us a call at 410-662-8780. Our email address, midday@wypr.org, and our Twitter handle, @MiddayTomHall. Let's go back to the phones. Ricky from Baltimore, welcome to Midday with Chris Bedford and Katie Rothkopf.
Hi. How are you guys doing?
Doing great. Thanks for your call.
So I just wanted to call to say I'm a big fan of Katie Rothkopf. She was a client of mine when I lived in D.C. She was a great curator at the BMA, and there's one show that made me fall in love with not only her work, but the BMA overall, a show she did on Pizarro. Both my brother and I are huge fans of her work. I don't think Baltimore realizes what they have in that museum and what they have in Katie Rothkopf. The work is on par with any other museum in the world. I mean, it is absolutely spectacular, from lighting to everything. I mean, she does such an amazing job. So if the Pizarro show or the Diebenkorn Matisse show is anything like the Pizarro show, I am in for a huge feast. And I just want to thank you for all of your work, Katie. All the best.
Ricky, you are something. Thank you so much for your call, and I miss you, and I hope to see you this weekend.
All right. Well, I can report that Katie is verklempt. Fanning herself, bright red, and you've landed a punch there, Ricky. Good job. Thank you for your call. I appreciate it. Chris, when You talked about when you took this job, you understood that the importance of the collection is a big factor for you. It can't be understated how important the fact is that Baltimore has all of these Matisses. Matisse is this huge figure. Most folks, I think, would guess Matisse and Picasso, perhaps the two biggest names in the 20th century in the art world. Is that fair enough? I'm guessing.
But I think there are some that would debate it, but I think it's a fair claim, and a defensible claim. Yes.
And here in Baltimore, Charm City itself, we have the largest collection of Matisses in the world. What does that mean for the capacity of the BMA to have an impact on the art world internationally? As Ricky is saying, that it's underappreciated. Perhaps that's true.
No, I think that's... Well, I don't know if it's underappreciated, and if it is, then it's certainly going to be our mission to correct that misapprehension. So I would say that it's a terrific question. It's one about the relationship of a city to its patrons. So one of the reasons, one of the chief reasons that we have such staggering holdings in Matisse is the patronage and advocacy of the Cohn sisters. So I think our job is to not rest on our laurels and understand history as the moment where the BMA made its mark, but the future too. So the question is, how do you write the next chapter in the history of an institution that makes it relevant to its present, engaging patrons who have a keen interest in propelling that future, much like the Cones did back then? I always say, and this is a very similar story to the Rose, when the Rose's collection was formed.
This is your former
museum. Yes, in Boston, yeah. Sam Hunter was the founding director. And he was looking at that point at Warhol and Rauschenberg and Johns. And at that point, those were not anointed figures in the history of art. These were emerging figures. And so he was really speculating about their tremendous value to the history of art. Similarly with the Cohn sisters. Of course, they had great advice. But the Matisse was not...
Yeah, in the 1920s, Matisse wasn't a superstar.
He wasn't the anointed icon of the modernist tradition that he is today. So there was some level of speculation and recklessness that I find really, really fascinating. And I think we have to capture that again.
So that leads to my next question, which is we have a sense then of how the BMA can contribute globally to the scholarship of this. But then, of course, the BMA exists here in this city. And this city has all sorts of challenges and all sorts of problems that have nothing to do with fine art, in a direct sense, but with the city facing challenges of racial inequality, facing challenges of economic inequality, facing challenges of access to healthcare. The kinds of things that we really do need to worry about as a community. Is there a way for the Baltimore Museum of Art or any of the other arts institutions? What's your understanding of the capacity of arts institutions in general to have an impact in a real and palpable way in a city?
So I would say that is the central question. And I've said in all sorts of public settings that if you're the head of a major institution in this city and that isn't the chief question that you're answering or addressing every morning, then you're probably doing the wrong thing. So my feeling is, yes, the relationship of the fine arts to the social conditions in Baltimore could be seen as oblique, that we can't directly impact income inequality or racial prejudice. My contention is that, in fact, artists can be a side door into those very difficult conversations and can really advance our understanding of what it means to forge a truly inclusive society, principally because they model those ideas in their work. They're able to speculate in the way they produce objects, whether that's a painting, a sculpture, an installation, or a video, that point the way for us. And I would, to ground that in a specific comment, I'm working at the moment with Mark Bradford, who is the U.S. representative to the Venice Biennale in 2017. I'm the commissioner for that project. And he is a man who works in the studio. He's an artist. He works in the studio on one hand to produce paintings that advance a dialogue that begins with Jackson Pollock, Mark Rothko, etc. And then on the other hand is an extraordinarily committed social activist who has his own not-for-profit in Los Angeles that helps with education and care for foster youth in L.A., 300,000 foster youth population in Los Angeles. So I would say that the most important artists working today are both formally inventive and social activists. So our future lies with them.
Good for him. And Katie, Richard Diebenkorn, I guess who's not thought particularly as a political painter or any or a political artist, but he did get involved in a State Department tour to what is now St. Petersburg, Leningrad, when he went in the 60s. That, of course, allowed him access to all sorts of Matisse paintings that you've told us about in this exhibition. But what was Diebenkorn's political involvement, if at all, past the State Department trip?
He was not a particularly political person. The trip to the Soviet Union was one that he was invited by the State Department to serve as a representative for the United States at a time when Russia and the United States were trying to have a little bit of cultural exchange. It was an exchange organized by President Kennedy and Premier Khrushchev, and he was invited to go. And for him, it was at a moment in his career when he was, I think, starting to get a little bit ready to move on to the next thing and was looking for new inspiration. And because of his interest in Matisse, of course, he wanted to take advantage of this rare opportunity. And went with his wife, was there for several weeks, and in fact only was really able to go to the museums, the Pushkin and the Hermitage, for just a couple of visits. Most of the time he spent in the studio, in artist studios, talking to artists and trying to make some sort of a connection, which I don't think he found very easy to do.
Chris Bedford, Matisse worked in painting as well, and when he became kind of infirmed toward the end of his life, he was doing cutouts and all these different things. Did Diebenkorn also work in other media besides painting, or is that a question for Katie? I mean, do either of you know? I mean, Matisse did sculpture, and he did all these other different things. Did Diebenkorn dabble in different things besides these beautiful, huge paintings?
Well, he did painting, he did sculpture, he did beautiful prints, and a couple of tiny little home sculptures that aren't out and about that he did when I think he was a little ill. But, he in general, he really spent most of his time painting and drawing. I think that he made over 5,000 drawings, much like Matisse. I mean, both of them spent part of each day drawing.
Busy dude. Good for him. Let's go back to the calls, to some calls. Michaela from Baltimore, welcome to Midday. You're with Chris Bedford and Katie Rothkopf from the BMA. How you doing?
Hi, I'm a student from Owings Mills, Maryland, in McDonough School. And I'm actually calling my class today. Went to a field trip to the BMA. Our teacher, we've been studying avant-garde for about 2 months now, and we've been studying artists like Matisse and Cézanne. And today, when we went to the BMA, we saw the Cohn collection, and we saw a couple of Matisse's there. So we were wondering what the exhibit would add to our experience if we were to see the Matisse and the Diebenkorn pieces in the exhibit that is being presented.
We have two museum professionals nodding their heads approvingly. Thanks for your call, Michaela. I'm glad you enjoyed your trip to the BMA. What do you think, Katie?
Well, Michaela, yes, thanks for calling in. I'm so glad that you came in on your class trip. If you come and see the show that we've just organized, you will see certainly more examples by Matisse, another 36 of them. But you'll really see another artist in the 20th century who took some of the same ideas of color and structure and interest in showing his working process directly on the canvas or directly on the piece of paper. And I think it's an exhibition that I think you and your classmates would really, really enjoy and would really learn. You'd learn something new about why Matisse was so important to artists of the next generation.
And Chris Bedford, we've got to finish up now, but your experience in your last two stops along the way and your professional journey were in colleges and universities. Here's a wonderful call from a young student here. Do you think you learned anything about engaging young people working in museums that were housed on university campuses?
Yeah, I mean, I think that they are, you have to recognize that the people coming to your museum, whether they're coming from Owings Mills High School, whether Brandeis University or Harvard University, they're potentially the next generation of museum professional. They're the people who might be telling the next story to the next young visitor. So to treat them accordingly and to try and entice them to enter this world, which is extraordinary, by the way, and a privilege, I think is important for us to consider.
Christopher Bedford is the director of the Baltimore Museum of Art. Katie Rothkopf is the senior curator of European painting and sculpture at the BMA. The big new show is a beaut. It's called Matisse Diebenkorn. It opens Sunday at noon, and it'll be there until the end of January. Come on over to wipr.org/midday. We'll show you some images, and we'll share with you some details, including an event that includes Mr. Diebenkorn's daughter, Gretchen, who's making a talk or giving a talk at the BMA. So again, wipr.org/midday, and we'll have the details on that. It is Midday, and I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us. Coming up after a very quick break, we'll check in with Marvin Pinkert, who'll tell us about what's cooking at the Jewish Museum of Maryland. Here's a hint: chicken soup. Eat something. We'll talk. Stay with us.
You're tuned to Midday on 88.1 WYPR, your NPR news station.